From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You may never have read or seen a play from Shakespeare. Doesn't matter. The writer Stephen Marsh says Shakespeare has changed your life. Doesn't matter your education level or what you do, there's a pretty good chance that over the last day or so you've used an expression or a word that Shakespeare made up. He created nearly 2,000 of them. But it's more than that. It was how he used these words to move an audience that Marsh says makes Shakespeare hands down the most influential person who ever lived. Today in the program, we're broadcasting live from Cedar City at the Utah Shakespeare Festival. We'll talk about Shakespeare's influence, about the challenge of staging a festival like this. We'll also compare the difference between the real life and Shakespeare's dramatic version of Richard III. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, How Shakespeare Changed Everything, the writer and scholar Stephen Marsh says that William Shakespeare belongs to this moment, to the confusing and constantly changing world of the 21st century. Marsh says Shakespeare still works because he created a world that is filthy and exalted, cheap and rarefied, gorgeous and vile. Sound familiar? And don't tell David Ivers and Brian Vaughn, the new co-directors of the Utah Shakespeare Festival, that Shakespeare is worn or dated. Their productions of Midsummer Night's Dream and Romeo and Juliet are selling out. And look, there's a reason the festival is celebrating its 50th season this year. Shakespeare is still resonating with audiences. But for directors and actors and even the organizers of Shakespeare festivals, it's always a challenge to make Shakespeare work in the context of a time. And what a time it is now, a digital and information era where old models of media and entertainment are falling by the wayside when there are more distractions than ever. Today in the program, we're broadcasting in the shadow of the Adams Memorial Shakespearean Theater here in Cedar City, Utah, talking about Shakespeare today. Later on the program, we'll explore Shakespeare's complicated villain, Richard III, based, by the way, on a true story. But first, Brian Vaughn and David Ivers are joining us. They are, as I said, co-artistic directors of the Shakespeare Festival. Among Brian Vaughn's many performances at the festival, the title roles of Hamlet, Henry V, Cyrano de Bergerac. This season, he plays Harold Hill in The Music Man. And Brian Vaughn, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. David Ivers has been in about 30 productions for the Utah Shakespeare Festival, including Much Ado About Nothing and The 39 Steps. And this season, he's directing Romeo and Juliet. And David Ivers, welcome to you.
Thank you.
I wanted to begin this way. Is there a myth about the Shakespeare Festival, something that you find yourselves working against? Before you did anything, when you took the job last year, so was there a myth that you had to sort of contend with?
Wow. I don't know. Other than the ingredients for the tarts that we sell in the sweet shop. What do you think?
Okay, well, look, this is what I'm getting at. Is there some idea out there that you wanted to deal with, that it's too safe, or that it isn't quite, is there a myth, something that bothers you, something that you have to deal with?
Well, I will say, it's not something it bothers us. I think it's something that I think David and I are interested in sort of exploring the parameters that have been set. Yeah. One of the things that I think is unique to this festival, and it's part of the mission that Fred established in the creation of this amazing theater, is to present the plays of William Shakespeare in a time frame that exists within the span of his life. So, 15, late 1500s, early 1600s.
On the Adams stage.
On the outdoor stage, yeah. In the outdoor Adams Theater. And I love that, and I believe in it, and I appreciate it. And yet at the same time, I'm also curious about how to present an Elizabethan drama in a time period that's not necessarily Elizabethan, yeah, but still reflects Elizabethan ideas and themes and structure that William Shakespeare was dealing with on our outdoor stage, specifically. So that's one of the things that interests me.
What your boundary is.
What our boundary is, yeah, and how we can sort of push outside that boundary. It's something that's just been permeating with David and I. It's something that we don't want to tarnish also, because I think there's a, you know, setting a play outside one of his plays in a time frame that goes parallel to the theme, or goes contrary to the themes in the play, does not interest me at all. Setting it in an anachronistic time period that is not reflective to what Shakespeare intended is not something that I'm interested in.
Do you see that from time to time?
Yes, you do. I do.
Yeah. Like stylizing it, but like, what?
Why? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That makes no sense. Yeah. Setting it on the moon or whatever, you know what I mean? Which we would never do. I'm interested in setting it in a time frame that is reflective of that time frame, as well as the parallels within the time frame that Shakespeare was writing about and how they equal one another. Yeah. That's something that interests me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he wrote his plays in modern dress.
Yeah.
Lest we forget.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an interesting question, and I think it's a wonderful question. It's challenging because you sort of, you know, myth implies, is there some large thing that may or may not be true, you know, that's mythic about what the perception is of our work. I think this issue of, which you spoke about a little bit in your introduction, the digital age and relevance of Shakespeare is constantly disproven by the people that sit in our audiences and the people that enjoy and are challenged by the productions that we present. I do think that there is, it is, as you also stated, a challenge to continue the search for relevance. But we're often so amazed at how people come out, and especially at this festival, that people are advocates for their own families, generations within their own families, to make sure that part of their children's lives and their grandchildren's lives is access to this incredible work here. And that's something that makes us truly unique. But we do have a responsibility, Brian, myself, and the rest of our staff, to figure out a way to continue to engage a new generation of audience. We say lovingly that one of the things we notice when we're on stage is a vast majority of our audience got behind Fred's vision, and they're still with him, and they're still here. And that's brilliant and wonderful. But in 30 years, we need to be on stage when maybe I'm playing Lear by that time and see that generation of audience that has come with Brian and I. That's the charge.
I want to sort of get at this question of relevance. You and I have been talking a little bit about this, and you know, we're sort of framing the conversation the way I mentioned it. You know, how do you make Shakespeare relevant? That's the word I used. But it's a word that you're kind of cynical about, at least the way the word is used, because for you, the question isn't relevance as much as it is taste. And I wanted you to get at that, if you would.
Well, you and I have talked about this, and I think I look at, you know, how is it relevant, or how do you maintain its relevance? And his work is relevant. The themes in Shakespeare's work are relevant continuously. That's why they're still being produced. That's why we're having a hard time getting people into Midsummer Night's Dream in the evening and Romeo and Juliet. The proof is in the pudding. People find its relevance and its context. So then the deeper question becomes for me, are we really talking about taste, how you want to see it interpreted and performed? Some people want us to maintain a very strict, boundaried performance around a classical style in the outdoor theater. Brian and I don't disagree. We also have several members of our audience, younger members, to be truthful to you, that say, when are you going to shake it up? When are we going to see something outside that might be in jeans and leather motorcycle jackets, you know? Well, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if you'll ever see that in the outdoor theater.
But want it as an option.
Well,
right?
Possibly. I think we want as an option that the opportunity to explore the dialogue about artistic vision, and solely for the reason to continue to examine the themes of this astonishing writer. We do have the option of doing that in the Randall Jones, and several of our audience members have seen that, and to great success. And so I think that that's good for us right now. You know, we're not in the business of fixing stuff that's not broken, you know. Yeah. But it's important to have the conversation and have the dialogue, because the relevance issue is being proven continuously, not just at this festival, but all over the country in terms of Shakespeare's work. I'm interested to hear from Mr. Marsh, because I think that's important to him as well. But yeah. And then it becomes like, okay, is it about taste? You know, is it about, I like it this way, and somebody else wants to see it this way. And I said in the seminar last week to someone who was had some interesting comments about Romeo and Juliet, and I just simply said, do you like milk chocolate? And they said, yes, I love it. I said, I hate it. I like dark chocolate. Next question.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I often wonder, you know, what the response would be like if we did a full Elizabethan production on our indoor stage. Yeah. You wouldn't hear any comments about that, you know, and it's a completely modern setting. It's not an open air roof, you know, and then it, or on a modern sort of setting, you know, set it in a modern setting, but Elizabethan dress, what yeah. that would do for an audience, you know, and just the contradiction sometimes about the comments. And I think it does level down to what David is targeting, which is taste, individual taste.
So I wonder if you guys have a sense of how far you can push yet. And I wanted to talk about a couple of particulars. I mean, the reaction you're getting for 2012, let me ask you about that. You're thinking about, or I'm not sure if you've settled this, but you're thinking about only staging two Shakespeare productions in 2012. Is that right?
Three, actually. We have
three.
One in our fall season,
right.
Production of Hamlet in the fall season. So.
But not as much as you have in the past. And we can talk about the particulars of that, but I'm interested in the reaction that you're getting. And you're going to put a non-Shakespeare piece on this stage.
For the sixth time?
Oh, is it? So you've done it before. But
Faustus, Cyrano de
Bergerac,
right?
Holiday.
Yeah.
Volpone.
But how are people reacting? I mean, I think that's the question, because again, here's the boundary. How far can we push?
Well, and that's, yes, we have gotten feedback. Why are you doing Mary Stuart on the outdoor stage? And my answer is because it's a great play about an Elizabethan theme. That's perfectly synonymous with a Tudor setting in an Elizabethan theater. And it's about, you know, Mary Queen of Scots and the rivalry between her and Queen Elizabeth during the Elizabethan age. It's perfectly Shakespearean, you know, and reflective of the era, and I think is going to play with tremendous strength outside, you know. And the interesting thing about it is that Fred Adams, our founder, has been a staunch supporter and advocate of the choice. In fact,
he brought
loved
it to
it.
Us.
He thought he was the one who said, you have to do this play. And that's the interesting thing. And I think because maybe we're not presenting, you know, oftentimes in the past we've presented two Shakespeare outside. If we've done Cyrano outside, we've done another Shakespeare on the indoor stage.
Yeah.
This year we decided not to do that just based on our programming. We just decided, let's put a Shakespeare in the fall. It's a very popular production of Hamlet in the fall. We're trying to target that to younger demographic. Focusing on school groups to come see that play, to get them into the audience. Something that's in their curriculum and a play that all students should see at some point in their life, Hamlet. Outdoors, we wanted to show an early revenge tragedy, Titus Andronicus, the show, the early writer of Shakespeare. And we sort of bookended that with Hamlet at the tail end of that, where you've seen the work of Shakespeare, where he's mastered this theme. The other interesting element of it is we're also committed to producing the entire canon of William Shakespeare's plays over the next 10 to 12 years.
Which you've never done.
We have completed the canon once.
Once?
In our 50-year history.
No.
Well, partially. We have
almost.
Almost.
Yeah, okay.
Have any of you seen Two Noble Kinsmen?
Right.
Gear yourselves up now.
Exactly. And some of the plays were combined into one evening. For instance, we've done the Henry VI plays in one combination, an adapted script of all three plays into one play. We are interested in producing all of his plays over the next 10 to 12 years. That's important to me. I think some of those plays are just as viable and important as Romeo and Juliet or Taming of the Shrew. And our audiences need to see that. I've been here for 20 years, and there's a whole slew of plays I've never seen. And I think that's tragic.
Yeah, programming's tricky business, you know.
Yeah.
The Mary Stuart thing is astonishing, because I do think that there's an element, after having read several adaptations of it, that there are many audience members that would perhaps, if we weren't having this conversation, come to that show and think it was written by Shakespeare. We're not in the business of trying to turn this theater green. We're in the business of exposing people to great works that line up with the mission that Fred Adams have put us, you know, put us now as stewards of. You're going to love Mary Stuart. I'm telling you, there's not going to be a ticket available. It is more Elizabethan than anything he has written. Yet, it's challenging and political and full of sort of this wonderful drama, and still has this what-if kind of scenario. And we ask that you go along for the ride with us. The other thing is as Brian said, this commitment to producing the complete works, the canon of Shakespeare, is front and center for us. Our audiences deserve it. We're not called the Utah Parts of Shakespeare Festival. We looked at our programming, and we recognized that in the last 20 years, we have produced 18 of his plays over and over and over. Now, sometimes you have to do that. There's only 7 or 8 comedies, so they're going to come around. But, you know, we owe it to this community and to the next generation of theater goers to say, he also wrote this. He also wrote this.
I want to ask you this about this idea that Shakespeare is good Shakespeare anyway, which is like all good art, is kind of a reflection of who we are. David Ivers, let me ask you about this in the context of the play you're directing, Romeo and Juliet. You and I have talked about this. Different people are going to respond to that play in different ways. And it seems like this younger sensibility, and I've heard you use this word from sexy. Like that Romeo and Juliet, some see it as an incredibly sexy play. Mm-hmm. Some won't see it necessarily that way, but our perception of the way a play plays out is a reflection of who we are, right?
Yeah, I think so. And given that I'm tremendously sexy, it makes sense that only I would. No, I mean, I do. I see it as a play that is on boil because of the youth in the play. Their people's lives are exhausted. They're snuffed out. And they're snuffed out. We see it, just turn on the news, we see it because of how quickly and ferociously the youth in this play, as part of a multi-generational grudge, are hanging on to it. And there's lots of potential on one side or the other in idleness. And there is some idleness in the youth in this play. And for me, you know, that's one component of the production, but I've also said many times that becoming a father has reignited my interest in directing the play. I now see it in an entirely different way. And that's why I wanted to direct it. You know, it's not just Romeo and Juliet that have a tragedy. As a matter of fact, it's not really their tragedy. It's, of course, as we know, the survivor's tragedy. Mm-hmm. They're the people that have to get up the next morning and try to brush their teeth, and you know.
Before we head to a break, let me ask you both this finally. You mentioned sort of your education initiatives, and I wondered, what is it that ruins Shakespeare for young people? Crappy teacher.
You know, one of my main feelings of it is these plays were meant to be seen, and they were meant to be to come off of the page. That's where they started from. You know, I always say that to young people, you cannot sit down. You can sit down and read them, but they will not come alive until you get up and start speaking them, because then they become active and they become real and they become vital. And that, to me, is the problem that I think a lot of young people face with the play. They have to go down and they have to sit and read Julius Caesar in their room, and they don't get it. They don't get it. Rather than seeing it, getting up off their feet, reading it, speaking it out loud with another person, another student, then the plays come alive. They are meant to be seen. And that, to me, is one of the huge things about it with young people. And I think it scares a lot of people. I also think it scares a lot of educators also, yeah, and a lot of teachers, because they're not sure how to do it, you know? And the great thing about it is there's no blueprint. Just get up and do it. Start speaking it, and they will come alive, you know? That's the beauty of the meter, of the rhythm. It's natural speech, you know? And you kind of can't mess it up if you just start speaking it. The blueprint, the map of the meter goes with you. You know, once you start to follow it, it falls in naturally. And I think that's the one thing that a lot of people sort of, they fear, or they think that it's too technical or it's above them, it's something that they can't understand, when I think, in fact, it's just the opposite. You know?
Yeah, I was going to say, too, I think we definitely need to do a better job of this at the Utah Shakespeare Festival, even though we do a great job. It's one of the things that's also front and center for Brian and I. It's providing access. You know, some people just are scared of it because they don't have the opportunity or the access or the finances or the ability to go see it. done well. So you go to that one production that's awful at a community theater of, you know, King Lear for 4 hours, and who wants to do that, you know? So part of our responsibility in the corner of this state and with a theater that shares the name of the state is to provide and find places where we can bring access to what we do so that we have lifelong learners and lifelong supporters that get it because it's in three dimensions.
It's David Ivers. He and Brian Vaughn are co-artistic directors for the Utah Shakespeare Festival. We are live in Cedar City at the festival, helping it celebrate its 50th anniversary, and we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we worked out some technical bugs, and we're broadcasting Radio West today live from Cedar City, the Utah Shakespeare Festival, talking about the challenges of staging a festival like this in the digital age. Also, we're talking about how Shakespeare still matters and how Shakespeare's changed everything. Joining us now on the program is Stephen Marsh. He's a novelist and a columnist for Esquire magazine. He's taught Shakespeare at City College in New York. He's the author of the new book called How Shakespeare Changed Everything. And Stephen Marsh is joining us today from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. Stephen Marsh, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here, Doug.
I want to begin with this question of how you first started thinking about Shakespeare's influence on the present. And maybe you should explain, as you do in the book, your dissertation, which was about dead bodies.
Yeah, you really want to hear that? It's a bit boring. I mean, I did my dissertation on this changing attitude towards corpses in the 1540s and changes to the funeral laws, and then how that affected the drama about 50 years later. But that really has nothing to do with the book. The book is more about, you know, his impact on material life, on material history.
But that's how it got you there, right? That's what got you thinking about Shakespeare's influence on the present.
Teaching the kids, really. Teaching classes where I needed to figure out, you know, how do I explain the relevance of this guy, and then sort of stories would build up where I figured out how he actually had these incredibly bizarre impacts on even daily life.
Well, I want to talk about words. Shakespeare was constantly, I guess this is no surprise to some of the people gathered here, but he was constantly making up words. You say it's hard to know just how many words he added to the English language.
Yeah, etymology is always very vague. I mean, even contemporary words like computer, we don't really know the exact date or place of their composition. And of course, when you go back 400 years, things get a lot more vague. But the high end of the limit is about 1,700 words, which is a crazy number of words to add to any language. I mean, it dwarfs any other writer, and it's very basic words. The one that really blows me away is the name Jessica. You know, because nobody names their daughter Jessica because it sounds Shakespearean, or they want to sound educated or something like that. I mean, they name their daughter Jessica because they love the way it sounds. And he came up with that in The Merchant of Venice. So I just find that absolutely astonishing. Came out with skim milk, advertising, you know, very, very basic words that, you know, eyeball. I mean, nobody knows if he invented them or if he heard them on the street You know, or what. But, you know, it's the richness of his language. Even more, I think, his sort of gleeful appropriation of other people's language, that kind of even mattered even more, because that is the defining attribute of English, that we can take, you know, boondocks. The word boondocks is from Tagalog, you know. American soldiers in the Philippines brought it back. And that's a great English word. We don't really care that it doesn't really belong to us.
Expressions. It's Greek to me. Vanished into thin air. Playing fast and loose. Tongue-tied. Yeah. Hoodwinked. In a pickle.
Yeah. Green with envy. Snail's pace. Be all and end all. I mean, you know, I sometimes wonder if, you know, people going to the plays in Shakespeare's time, you know, we sort of think that there's this language gap that we have going backwards. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I wonder what it must have been like to go to the theater and hear a snail's pace for the first time. You know? Or skim milk. I mean, there must have been some kind of like linguistic distinction that we don't get now.
Well, you say in the book that Shakespeare may actually be easier to understand now.
Yeah, I think in a sense, because we're used to in that sense. I mean, it's not like people walked around the street talking, you know, to be or not to be. That is the question. You know, they you know, light thickens and the crows make way to the rookie wood is not something you would hear in the pub in, you know, 1599. But on the other hand, the newness of the language, the incredible freshness of his language, I think, you know, that's sort of lost to us now. But, well, it's not, you know, you recover it, but it's something that we are missing, I think.
What made him think he had the license to create a word if an existing one didn't suit him? I mean, did it show how incredibly confident he was in some way?
Well, I think he thought that was his job. I mean, you know, we're dealing with theater. We're dealing here with very close theater without a lot of special. I mean, there were special effects, but very few. You know, if he'd had CGI, he probably would have done CGI. But what he had was language. And he made language. He was the special effects master of language. I mean, he used it to create the effect in the audience that he wanted. And so he was really kind of extreme about that. You know, I mean, he just, that's probably not the most descriptive adjective, but I think he was constantly looking for an effect. And the way to get it was language. And if inventing words, you know, inventing highfalutin language was part of it, then he had to do that. If it was cheap puns and dirty jokes, he did that. So I think, you know, I think it was his job.
Yeah. It seems like the reason a lot of these phrases and words stick is because they sound right. They just...
Yeah, they have this incredible sense of rightness.
Yeah.
I mean, they just do. Like, bandit. You know, it just sounds better than bandito. And, you know, he took, you know, there is the Italian word, bandito, and he Englished it to bandit, but it just sounds right. Or assassination. You know, I mean, it's the correct sound. It just is incredibly right. I don't really have an answer for that one, you know? I mean, why he was able to find the right sound? It's one of those things. It's like, why can Michael Jackson find the perfect hook? You know, it's just a gift.
Do you think that, I mean, you write in the book that Shakespeare's influence comes down to what you describe as this almost supernatural ability to move an audience.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and this is the crucial question, of course, so it would be hard to even sort of get at, but you know, why? I mean, it's got to be more than just his ability to turn a phrase to create the right word. It's a collection of all of those kinds of things, I guess. Is that right?
Well, I mean, that is a million-dollar question, and I unfortunately do not have the answer. I mean, this is the answer that I do have. When I was writing this book, you know, I sort of the question that I was asking myself is, why did Shakespeare? You know, he had all these amazing effects on history, on language. He was sort of there at the assassination of Lincoln, and he had this effect on starlings and sexuality and race and all these sorts of effects. And Christopher Marlowe, who was also a great playwright in the period, or John Webster, didn't. Dante didn't. All these other great geniuses did not have this effect. So what is it about Shakespeare that causes him to have all this power, all this influence? And I mean, the only answer I really have is that in Shakespeare, you sort of find everything in humanity talked about very frankly. You know, you find horny teenagers and nasty Jewish businessmen, and you find saints, and you find monsters, and you find people of all walks of life, all classes, all types. And so, you know, it's kind of a pocket full of humanity. I mean, that's the answer that I came up with. It doesn't satisfy me completely, but it's really the best I can do.
We were talking earlier on the program about how you know, the challenge of presenting Shakespeare to young people, particularly young people of, you know, the information age. You write in your book that if you can't make a room full of young people care about Shakespeare, then you probably shouldn't be around young people or Shakespeare.
Well, I do think that, you know, when that sounds a bit harsh. But, you know, in my experience, when I was teaching literature, teaching things that you would think would be far more relevant, like Kafka, you know, the hunger artist, something like that, where it's just as like, yeah, let's talk about this in The Biggest Loser. That's hard. Whereas if a student doesn't really get Macbeth, they're not really going to get anything. I mean, to me, they're not really going to get literature. They're not ready for it. You know, I think Shakespeare is, you know, the question of his relevance is, which I heard you discussing earlier, is rather a fascinating one to me because, you know, you can put on a play that is super relevant, you know, that has, you know, let's say you put on a play with a Marine coming back from Iraq, you know, who's gay, and he's dating a banker who's involved in the financial crisis. You can put that on, and no one will come. You know, no one will come. If you put on Romeo and Juliet, people will come. You know, if you put on Hamlet, people will come. And why is that? And I think the answer is that what he talks about is immensely relevant. It's just, you know, if it's given clearly and if it's given cleanly, I think people, the vast majority of people respond to it. I mean, when I was doing the research into the book, I mean, he does spread of his own accord in the 19th century. It's wild reading that history.
You're pretty unequivocal about this, and I don't think it's just for effect, and I don't think it was just the prodding of your publisher. I mean, the book saying, you know, how Shakespeare changed everything, but you say Shakespeare, the most influential person who ever lived, and you're convinced of it.
Yeah, I am. I mean, it sounds wild, but I really didn't know what else to call the book, and I didn't take that first line very lightly. I mean, you know, he gave the primary expression of adolescence. He more or less invented the concept of adolescence that we still live with. He provided the core insights of Freud. He affected the civil rights movement more than any other author. He changed the birds in the sky over North America. He was there during the assassination of Lincoln. He has affected fashion. He has affected, you know, never mind culture. Like, I mean, those are things, I haven't even talked about culture yet. He is the dominant influence on Bollywood. Romeo and Juliet is the most adapted play in Hollywood. I mean, it's been adapted hundreds of times. His power, it's weird. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. He shouldn't be the most influential person in the world, but, you know, he's changed sex more than any other author, for sure. He's changed, he's had this enormous influence on our sex lives. You know, and that's just one thing. I really didn't know what else to call it after I'd listed all of those impacts, all of those effects.
So, Stephen Marsh, we're going to sort of transition here to talking about Richard III. So stay with us, if you would. Stephen Marsh, his book is called How Shakespeare Changed Everything. And we're broadcasting live from Cedar City on the campus of Southern Utah University, the Utah Shakespeare Festival, celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And we'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. Fabrizio. The Utah Shakespeare Festival is presenting Shakespeare's classic tale of ambition and passion, Richard III, this season, which, like a number of Shakespeare's plays, was based on an historical figure. The scholar Ace Pilkington says that the real Richard has little of the grandeur Shakespeare gave his incarnation, and, of course, he had no hump. We're going to talk about Richard III today, the real man and Shakespeare's character. Joining us is Ace Pilkington, the literary seminar director for the Utah Shakespeare Festival, also a professor of English and chair of humanities and social sciences at Dixie College in St. George, Utah. Among Pilkington's books is Screening Shakespeare from Richard III to Richard II to Henry V. And Ace Pilkington, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
We should also introduce Elijah Alexander. He's with us here, plays the title role in Richard III this season, also performing in A Midsummer Night's Dream. And Elijah Alexander, welcome to you.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Hi.
Stephen Marsh, I wanted to ask you about Richard III in the West, because you say that Richard III has an interesting history in the early days of the West during the Gold Rush. You say this play was really popular in Nevada, Utah, California. Why?
You know, Shakespeare was hugely popular in the Wild West. He would go into towns like Nevada. Yeah, sorry, he. I wish. you know, Shakespeare touring families would go through these towns and make fortunes. I mean, one Boston family made $60,000 one year. In a season. Richard III, when I was researching my book, one of the most interesting things I found was this editorial from the San Francisco Chronicle in like 1857 saying, please stop putting on Shakespeare because there's not a bootblack in the whole city who can't recite Richard III by heart. They've seen it so many times. And, you know, it was a question, why was Shakespeare so popular? And he really was on par with booze and gambling and hookers as a mode of pleasure.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, I think the answer is that, you know, a lot of people think of the Gold Rush people actually had a great average to grade six education, which was immensely high for the 1850s. They weren't you know, super educated men, but on the other hand, they weren't uneducated men either. And I think to abandon your family and go out in search of a great fortune requires a certain kind of grandeur of spirit. And I think Richard, for sure, even though he's evil, definitely is a grand spirit. You know, definitely has this enormous charisma, and you know, we all share in his complicity and sort of love him making it big, even while we kind of hate him.
Why? Because it was about ambition, and that's what that was about in those days.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, seeing ambitious men want to see ambitious men on stage, and I think the difficulties of ambition, the moral complexities of ambition, shall we say, you know, are put on stage in that play probably better than anywhere else except Macbeth, and which was also a hugely popular play in the West. So, you know, I mean, that's my explanation, but it, you know, it is pure speculation, and you know, it's just that's the best I can think of. I'm certainly open to others.
Well, Ace Pilkington, let me ask you to sort of help introduce us, those of us who are unfamiliar maybe with the character, sketch out the story and the character of Richard III for us for a moment.
You want the historical version or the Shakespeare version?
The Shakespeare version. We'll talk about history in a moment.
Okay, well, the Shakespeare version is of a good brother who supports Edward IV until he actually gets to the throne. While he's on the throne, he's a wonderful fighter, successful warrior, but he has a number of physical disabilities, and he has been treated badly by almost everybody for most of his life, including his mother, who hates him. And when his brother Edward IV dies, and in fact a bit before that, Richard decides that he ought to be the next king. He says in the Henry VI plays, "I'll hew my way to the throne with a bloody axe." And in Richard III, he basically proceeds to do so. One way and another, he gets rid of everybody who's standing between him and the throne, including his two nephews who disappear into the tower and are never seen again. He has the same problem that many leaders have, though. Once you get to be king, you're not the sniper anymore, you're the target. And from there on, it's downhill.
So that's the Shakespeare's figure. Let's set Richard in the context of history. He was an historical figure. This basic story is true, I suppose. Shakespeare's version is different from history's in some ways, which we'll get to, but did it matter to Shakespeare or the people who were seeing the play when he first wrote it that it was true, that the detail, I mean, did that matter in that day?
Not really. I mean, some of Shakespeare's histories, like Richard II and Henry V, are accurate. Some of them, like Macbeth, are wildly wrong. So, you know, it just depends on what Shakespeare's doing. He usually has a source to back up what he does, whether it's his ultimate story is right or wrong. He does have a source somewhere. He has Thomas More behind him on Richard III. And, you know, the overall picture of what Richard was like, the notion of Richard as somebody willing to do anything in order to be king, is true. The physical deformities and all of the murders, those are not historically accurate. But if you want to see Richard as a villain, there are plenty of modern historians like Desmond Seward who will tell you that Richard was the most terrifying man who ever sat on the English throne, not excluding Henry VIII.
Right. How dicey was it for Shakespeare to write about royalty in a time when, you know, the Queen could shut down the theaters and end his livelihood?
Well, it is very dangerous. You can be thrown into prison for any play, and Ben Jonson, among other playwrights, was. If you said the wrong thing in print, as one printer did, advocating that Queen Elizabeth get married, you could have your right hand struck off for, you know, printing the wrong thing. So it was very dangerous. With Richard II, when Shakespeare's company put the play on in the streets at one point, bribed to do so by the Earl of Essex, Elizabeth was furious, said, "I am Richard II. Know you not that?" Richard II hands his crown over to Henry IV to be. And only when Shakespeare's company could prove that they did it for the money and not for any political reason were they safe, but they still went on tour.
Wow. So we should mention that, of course, this play has generated a good deal of controversy. And it's interesting, we should say the king still has supporters. And they're not exactly crazy about the way Shakespeare portrays Richard III.
No, they're not. They have their own journal called The Ricardian. Many of them will not be happy until everyone agrees that Richard III was the greatest English king ever, that he didn't do anything wrong, and he certainly didn't kill his nephews. I'm willing to agree with them up to a certain point. I'm willing to agree that what they say, when they say Richard III was no worse than other English kings, I'm willing to go that far with them. After all, plenty of English kings killed nephews, uncles. Henry VIII executed a 12-year-old boy for treason, beheaded two of his wives, the younger of whom was 15 when he married her and 17 when he had her killed. So I don't think Richard was any worse than that.
Right. What the real Richard, of course, was not deformed physically. So how did that come about? Was that was a reflection of something? When did the hump emerge, I guess,
goes back to Thomas More and Edward Hall and even Polydor Virgil, with the notion that somebody that evil must have looked that way.
Yeah.
And also from Shakespeare's point of view, Shakespeare's Richard III is a more sympathetic character. I mean, this is somebody who has been mistreated because of what he looks like.
Wait, a more sympathetic character than the real...
Than the real one. The real Richard, who is handsome and successful and great on the battlefield. This is a guy who just wanted to be king, had the opportunity, had his nephews disappeared, and everything worked out for him until people started asking questions. Shakespeare's character has reasons for what he does. He has begun to resemble what he looks like because of the way people treat him.
Elijah Alexander, I'm dying to hear you on this.
So am I.
Okay, so can we start with the deformity and how it is that, how are you playing that part of the character and what part of that drives Richard?
Well, I think for me, any kind of physical limitation, in particular with this character, I guess, is sort of synonymous with what's happening psychologically and spiritually with this character.
Yeah.
So initially, my initial idea about it was that as Richard, begins his descent into complete corruption, his physical limitations become intensified. And I think we've done a little bit of that here. I think a lot of it is acted, and a lot of it is internalized, So I think for me, in approaching this character, the physical stuff is amazing material for an actor because it gives you immediate obstacles. And as they were with Shakespeare's Richard III, they're obstacles that he's had to overcome. So it's amazing to have that kind of a blueprint, physical blueprint for the character to start with. And then I guess you just explore, what I've been doing is exploring how that affects everything else.
Mm.
Sort of moving from the outside in, which is actually, from a lot of my career, has been the way I work, develop how a character moves, where he carries, what he leads with, and then moving inward from that. And this is just the richest material because you have artistic license, you have great language, you have physical limitations to overcome. You can't, of course, play obstacles, but you can use them, and it all reveals character, and then hopefully makes for some compelling drama.
Do you Ace Pilkington, let me ask you this first, and then Elijah, I want to get your perspective. Do we have to, I guess this is true of any great character, but we have to like him, right? We have to him a little bit.
We do, especially at the beginning. We have to be on his side because he's a kind of subordinate playwright. And if we're not on his side, if we don't want him to succeed, then basically we want the play to be over and we want to go home early. And this is bad.
Yeah, yeah. So Elijah, how do you, I mean, you've got to, I have to care about you even though you're a...
Yeah.
Dreadful human being.
That's the greatest challenge, to be honest. And as Ace said, it has to be done right from the beginning, and pretty much with that first speech. And it was tough because I didn't have my scene partner until the audience showed up. So you can rehearse that for as long as you want, but until they're there, and I'm connecting with them, and I've developed some kind of empathy.
Yeah.
The play doesn't happen. So, and of course, you know, it's daunting because it's one of the most famous speeches. You know, you can read.
We're talking about Now is the Winter of Our Discontent.
Now is the Winter of Our Discontent. Yeah. And there's so much, you know, on the page, it seems like, you know, it's expositional and the story thus far, but there's so much, it's so complex, and it requires an audience, the exchange, the connection. So it was interesting, you know, I didn't, and I'm still discovering it, but I didn't, it's important to develop a mutual, human, empathetic connection with the audience, and then the play can start. And I know, too, I know immediately if it's there, and what, and the varying degree of that connection, and then I have to move on from there, and it's frightening and exhilarating.
Well, you know,
at the same time,
the thing that strikes me about it is seeing the play from the audience perspective, because you're confessing to me. I'm a part of it. Mm. Which gives it a kind of a creepier element, I have to say.
Well, because as Ace and Stephen, I believe, said, the audience becomes complicitous. The audience is given a choice. Here you're this man who you're being introduced to for the first time is confessing to you what he intends to do. And I think it's an intention and less assured than some other interpretations may be. I mean, that was actually one of the things I really wanted to work on, was having a real journey with this character, with the audience. So much of what Richard says is seemingly self-assured, but I think if Richard is playing supreme confidence, there's nowhere to go. Hmm. He needs the audience to help him.
Can confirm what he's saying.
To confirm what he's saying, and to help him along. He needs to not only encourage himself by expressing these thoughts aloud, he needs the audience to in turn support him in this journey. And it's really tricky because, you know, he's saying, I'm going to be a villain and I'm going to commit these acts. But he's not sure how he's going to do it. And so, you know, the complicity of the audience is required. And so,
For us as the audience, here is a politician who is telling us the absolute truth.
Yeah.
A very unusual experience.
Well, Stephen Marsh, let me bring you back into this question about, it's a political play, right? I mean, I guess this really must resonate, particularly today, Richard III, in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think it's always fun to play the bad guy. You know, I mean, I think it's always, that's always the funnest role to play. So, I mean, I just saw Richard III a couple weeks ago and I just loved it, because you just get this, like, let's really wreck these people's lives. I mean, you really, I don't know, maybe that says more about me, but I was just really, really into it. I mean, I think the hacking scandal in Britain actually is incredibly reminiscent of Richard III to me. I mean, you know, you have machinations of power, people, you know, because the question in Richard III all the way through it is, who controls the story? Richard explicitly says at the beginning, you know, I am determined to prove a villain. He's making himself a character in a story that he then converts to his own way. You know, it is a sort of, it's spin. I mean, you know, he even has this part where he calls the audience in to, you know, this fake audience for this, you know, political performance on stage and makes them act in a certain way so that it can be reported. It's just a fascinating sort of, you know, what you would call, if you were being shallow about it, postmodern, in the sense that, you know, it's about narrative and narrative within narrative, you know, but it's 500 years old. I mean, I think it's absolutely incredibly close to the political situation in Britain right now.
Stephen Marsh is the author of the book How Shakespeare Changed Everything, which we should mention is available in the gift shop here at the festival.
Oh, nice.
Joined us from the CBC in Toronto. Stephen, thanks very much for the time.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Ace Pilkington, the literary seminar director for the festival. Ace, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Elijah Alexander plays the title role of Richard III. Break a leg, and thanks.
Thanks, my pleasure.
And thanks again to Brian Vaughn and David Ivers, of course, co-artistic directors for the Utah Shakespeare Festival. Guys, thanks again.
Thank you.
Richard III continues through September 3rd. The other plays on the season, Midsummer Night's Dream, Romeo and Juliet, which we mentioned in the Randall Jones Theater, is Music Man, The Glass Menagerie, Noises Off. In September and October, they're going to be staging The Winter's Tale and Dial M for Murder. For all of those details, you can find that at our website, KUER.org/Radio West. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Nikki Allen and Cammie Terry at the Shakespeare Festival. Thanks also to Cynthia Martinez and KUER's Janae Payne, John Green, Michael Havey, Mike Anderson, and Lewis Downey. Our engineer here in Cedar City is Bill Ramsey, the program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.